You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this past week. And today, our panel includes Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. Thanks, everyone, for taking off for Labor Day for just another hour. We appreciate you. How's it going this Friday?
Only for you, Samantha.
It's extraordinary, Samantha. Just extraordinary.
All right, Kevin, you're going to say that a lot because yesterday lawmakers piled into the State House in Boise for a special extraordinary session, which is what it's officially called, of the Idaho
Legislature. That is literally the word. That's their word, not mine.
It's true. It's true. And Kevin, Kelsey, and Brian, you were all riveted on the action, so let's break it down. Kevin, I'm going to have you set up the session. Why did lawmakers come to town?
Well, they came to town because Governor Brad Little directed them to come to town with one bill to consider, and it was his bill, and it passed over the course of 10 hours. Yeah, he signed it into law last night. The recap, what it does is it's going to provide $500 million in immediate tax credits. Those, they say, you should start to see in the mail in the next few weeks. It also reduces income tax rates to a flat rate of 5.8%. And tax wants are really big on this, going to the flat rate. To them is really, that's a big deal here. And that's about $150 million a year in tax relief. But in our education world, the thing we'll be watching really closely, $410 million of new money into education, $330 million for K-12, $80 million for a fund that will support helping students get ready for in-demand careers. So a lot in the bill, a lot to unravel, and a lot to watch to see how it works in the future.
Definitely a lot in there. We talked to quite a bit this week on the show about how the session would put cash toward education. And so we're excited to find out how that actually worked out. But who can explain to me how much money I'm going to get as a tax rebate? How much cash am I going to get in my pocket right before the November election, coincidentally? who wants this one? Kelsey, somebody, when do I get my cash and how much am I getting as a voter?
Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, okay. Well, it's... Thanks, Kelsey. It's at least $300 for an individual filer, no matter how much you pay. And this goes back to 2020. So if you filed a return in 2020, and if I get any of this wrong, Kelsey and Brian, don't let me solo here. $300 for an individual filer, $600 for a couple, no matter what you paid or what you owed in 2020. And then it would be 10% of what you paid. You know, if you're above that floor level, you would get at least 10% of what you paid out in 2020. Did I get that right?
So I'm getting at least $300 if I paid taxes in 2020, estate taxes.
If you filed a return.
Right.
I don't even think you had to pay taxes, if I'm remembering this correctly.
Wow. So I get $300 and then I get more if I paid.
Right. $300 is the floor. Yeah. But if you say you paid if you paid $5,000 in state taxes, you would get $500.
That's pretty handy right before the election. Thanks.
I think part of why he wanted to sign it so quickly was so that they could get those checks in the mail as soon as possible. And so I think part of the hurry up and go yesterday was I think part of that, so that we can get them in the mail as soon as possible. Because I think some of the impetus for it was, you know, about inflation costs. And so people are dealing with high gas prices and high food prices right now. And so they do want to get that in people's pockets as soon as possible.
Gotcha. And that's, I know one of the points, Kelsey, that I saw some people talking about was, why are we doing it right now? Why don't we just wait until the legislature comes around? So that makes sense. Brian, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that's kind of a double-edged sword with it is doing it right now. A lot of these legislators won't be there in January, and the new legislature is going to get to decide what to do with that education funding. And that was a point of concern yesterday among some legislators who like the education funding, but they said, you know, there's nothing in here stopping the next legislature from just cutting what they were going to put in education based on what happened yesterday. And so, you know, we might get the money soon, for the tax portion, but the rest of it might be a little bit up in the air.
That was one of my questions. It's a little confusing there. Is this a done deal? I mean, it sounds like the next legislature, which will have a lot of new people, because we know a lot of people just aren't going to be in the next legislature. Will they're going to get a say on what happens with the education money?
They're going to get a big say, because none of that policy was baked into this bill, now law. It doesn't spell out where the money would go. So it's really going to be up to this next legislature, and Kelsey pointed it out. A lot of new faces, at least 42 new legislators are going to be in the State House in January. A bunch of them are going to be on the Budget Committee. A bunch of them are going to be in the Education Committees. The fact of the matter is, we don't know where exactly that money will go. And there are going to be a lot of ideas about where that money could go. Teacher pay, classified salaries. There's a lot of districts are really struggling to hang on to bus drivers, cafeteria workers, custodians, and on down that list. School facilities is a big deal. We saw a couple of big bond issues fail in Canyon County just this week. So those are ideas. I think you'll see some discussion as well about whether any of this money should go into school choice. It's a blank slate, and a lot of new legislators are going to get to put a mark on that slate.
And if you were following, you know, people yesterday who have been elected in their primaries and who are either unopposed or very much expected to win their general election, a lot of them were not very happy about what happened yesterday, and they were not happy about the education funding piece. And so I think, depending on how the committees shake out, and JFAC is going to look very different next year too, as far as the new members, because we've lost quite a few of those in the primaries.
That's
so
the
it's going to look pretty different.
Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, which is
yes.
The one that holds, handles all the money. You raise a good point, Kelsey, and because Brian, I was going to ask you, the Idaho Statesman had some quotes from a lot of lawmakers that Governor Little basically put lawmakers into a corner. Is that true? It sounds like a lot of them didn't like Little's bill, but they voted for it anyway because it looks really bad if you vote against kids and free cash right before an election.
Yeah, it really was kind of a masterful political maneuver. I've never seen lawmakers spend so much time complaining about a bill before voting for it. And it was it passed overwhelmingly. It was there were only 15 no votes in the House and one in the Senate, despite most of the debate being against the bills, or at least questioning the bill. So it will be interesting to see. I think the biggest question that'll hang out there is whether the education funding, whether they can bring that across the finish line, because as both Kelsey and Kevin had said, the makeup's going to be much different, particularly in the Senate. The Senate, you had a lot more very conservative members who defeated incumbents this time around. So the Senate is going to look much different. And I think it's going to be something to watch closely next year.
And go ahead.
And what'll be interesting to watch too is, assuming that Governor Little is reelected, and right now he's a prohibited favorite, what does he do if budgets come in on education lower than expected? He has stated that he sees this money, this $410 million for education, as additional money, as new money, not a replacement, not money that you use. You fold this sales tax money into education and you trim the education budgets elsewhere. He has said that is not his intention. And let's face it, let's smell the coffee here. He did this because he wanted to preempt the Reclaim Idaho initiative, which would put $330 million into K-12. Yeah, he's kind of honor bound now if he's there. And let's assume, for sake of argument, that he is. He's honor bound to make sure that this new money is indeed new money and not a budget shell game, as Representative Elena Rubel referred to it as potentially becoming.
It's a very good point. And Kevin, check me. I think you said 42 new lawmakers.
At least.
Yeah. So that's out of, if my memory serves, 105 in the Idaho legislature.
A lot of new faces.
So.
That's, names to recognize or to memorize.
You're getting up towards half there. That could make a real change in how the legislature works and maneuvers. And Kelsey, you mentioned the budget committee. I mean, that could make a real change in how things work inside the legislature, and ergo how things come back out. So there's no guarantees for this. And as you said, Kevin, basically this maneuver yesterday will, no matter what voters do with the Quality Education Act, which is on the ballot in November, will cut that off at the knees, because the Quality Education Act, if passed by voters, would go into effect January 1st, and this bill goes into effect the 3rd. Is that right? Or the
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, it would revert the income tax levels back to pre-reclaim initiative levels. So exactly. The reclaim initiative, for all purposes, it will not be implemented as it appears on the ballot. It's just, you know, the legislature saw to that yesterday.
Wow. This is, go ahead, Kelsey.
Well, and not for nothing, but when you have half of the legislature coming in new almost, that's a lot of people getting up to speed on how the legislature works and how the budget process is run and how everything comes together. And so it's going to be interesting to see how quickly these new legislators can come up to speed and be trained and understand how all of these moving parts come together when they're trying to maneuver millions of dollars in new funding.
It's a really good point. And those few legislators, those relatively few legislators who come back in next session with experience on the budget committee, with experience in the education committees, with experience in the tax committees, are going to have all that much more influence and clout because they know what they're doing. They've been there before. They know how the process works. They know how the inner workings of the budget are put together. So experience is really going to matter next session because there ain't going to be a lot of it to go around.
Good point. I want to talk about a story that may be flying under people's radar. This wasn't as sexy as some of the other stories this week, but it's really important. If you like eating food, drinking water, and working a job in Idaho, Brian, let's talk about the 2015 water agreement that is apparently in danger of falling apart. In a nutshell, what is the agreement? Take us back to 2015.
So the agreement was meant to resolve disputes between surface water irrigators and fish farms in the Magic Valley. These are folks who use water that is discharged out the end of the East Snake Plain aquifer onto the surface. And farmers up in the eastern part of the state who mostly irrigate their crops with groundwater pumped out of that aquifer. There had been a series of disputes that were threatening to shut off water to much of the eastern part of the state here, which includes some of the areas, the state's most productive cropland, a lot of the biggest potato fields, barley fields, things like that.
And
go ahead.
Why is the agreement falling apart now?
So the deal that was struck basically required the eastern part of the state to do a variety of conservation measures. And one of the most important was aquifer recharge. So basically they would buy some water up from a reservoir, run it down the Snake River, run it out into the desert, let it flow into the ground with the idea that then it would return to the surface water irrigators over time. The expectation from the eastern side of the state was that would kind of average out. So you could do that when you had good water years like we had in 2017 and 2018. But then when you were in a drought, you wouldn't have to do as much. The dispute right now is that the surface water users say, no, you have to meet your recharge requirements every year. And because of that, there's actually any hour expected decision by the head of the Idaho Department of Water Resources about whether or not the eastern Idaho farmers are in breach of this agreement. If they are found to be in breach of the agreement, then up to 105,000 acres could immediately lose water right before the harvest, you know, just crops wilting. It would be a massive curtailment, and that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, because the water situation looks to get worse from here. So it'll have very significant economic consequences for the state.
There's some fascinating information on this in the Idaho Statesman story. You quote one farmer saying the settlement agreement will all go to hell. There are other really scary stuff in here. You've got words like it's really scary from one farmer. It would be devastating, enormous crop losses. You mentioned shutting off water to up to over 100,000 acres. There are furious negotiations going on. I don't think we can underestimate how bad this could be.
Yeah. When you talk to, I've been talking to more farmers today, and they're reporting things like they're getting lowball offers on their land and on their water rights. They're worried that, as one of them said, that the vultures are circling. So it is a very, very significant situation. It has flown under the radar, but if you talk to a farmer or a rancher in eastern Idaho or the Magic Valley right now, it's the only thing on their mind.
Well, and maybe that's why it's under the radar. I mean, I live in Boise. I don't have a farm. I don't grow potatoes. I don't raise cows. When I turn on my water, there's always water coming out of the faucet. So, it's easy not to care, but you're talking about not just people's livelihoods and jobs and land. You're talking about billions of dollars in agriculture in the eastern part of the state. And when you start curtailing water, that's not just for people who, are growing sugar beets. That's for people who live in cities that might get their water turned off if this goes away.
So far, there's a separate deal that covers the cities, and so far that seems to be holding up. But it's important to emphasize that all this is just the crisis of this year. There's a longer term picture here that's fairly bleak, and it's due to climate change. Climate change is meaning less snow up in this area. You talk to people who've lived here a long time, and it's just noticeable within their lifetimes that there's much less snow than there used to be. And so less water means more conflict over the water that's left. And so you can expect this to keep showing up year after year and likely to get worse. So it'll be a long-term story to keep an eye on.
And we've got more and more people coming to Idaho all the time. We've got more businesses coming to Idaho. And big businesses, food manufacturing plants and others, they use a lot of water. They need water for that.
Absolutely. And even things like the new Meta facility. If you're going to run a big data farm, water is actually a very important part of providing cooling. The old saying, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over, that may just have started.
Oh, man. All right. So let's get to what might have been the top news story of the week in Idaho if there had not been a special session and a Micron announcement. And that's former Idaho Representative Aaron Von Ellinger being sentenced to at least 8 years in prison for rape. Kelsey, start at the beginning. Who is Von Ellinger for people who don't know? What did he do? And what happened this week?
Well, the beginning started more than a year ago, stemming from a night in March 2021 when then 39-year-old Aaron Von Ellinger, who was representing Lewiston at the time, took a 19-year-old legislative intern from the Capitol to dinner and took her back to his apartment. And there, she said he forced her to perform oral sex, and there was a subsequent ethics hearing where they discussed his conduct, decided it was unbecoming of a legislator, and he was recommended to be suspended from the legislature, and then he resigned shortly after that came down. So then there were criminal charges that were filed a few months later, and that trial's been going on since, I think, November is when it really got underway. And last week, I think it was the 24th or 25th, he had requested a new trial after he was convicted in the end of April this year. And he was denied that by the judge because the judge determined there were no constitutional violations of his right to confront his accuser since she didn't testify. And that there was no compelling new evidence to warrant a new trial. So his sentencing was shortly afterward because they already had a chance to do a lot of the pre-sentence work. And the judge ultimately decided that his term would be a total of 20 years, but with 8 fixed and 12 years kind of indeterminate based on his behavior in prison. The evaluation that they did before the sentencing showed that he had a low probability of rehabilitation. I think it was either low or moderate, based on his willingness to admit he did anything wrong, his willingness to say that anything needed to be treated in him, and just kind of overall hostility to the process and willingness to blame the victim is kind of what the judge talked about. So it did not go well for him ultimately at the sentencing.
So at least 8 years in prison. Is there going to be an appeal? Do we know? Is he going to appeal the sentence?
We don't know at this point. I have not seen an appeal yet, but I would expect one. Yes, it's likely, especially given the way that he conducted himself at the sentencing. It doesn't seem like he's willing to accept what came down. So I would be on lookout for it.
All right. Okay, Kevin, before all the other excitement this week, we had some school bond and levy elections. Let's talk about what happened. I did a little math, and I did it early, so double check me, please. Looking at your stories, it looks like there were 11 elections. 12. Okay, 12. See, I told you. It was early.
Okay, it's close.
6 of those failed. Does that mean voters are tired of voting to raise their taxes to pay for bonds and levies and education and things?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of trying to draw sweeping conclusions from any round of school elections because it's a pretty small sample size and these elections are really local. But it was a tough Tuesday for a lot of school districts that had some big ticket ballot measures before voters. Coeur d'Alene had the largest of the bunch. It was an $80 million plant facilities levy, and a lot of the money that they wanted to spend would go into school safety, go into securing campuses. Valley View had a bond issue for some new school construction. Middleton had a bond issue for new school construction. And these are all three, they're larger districts, and they're fast-growing districts. A lot of growth going on in Coeur d'Alene, obviously. Anybody who's driven through Canyon County knows that there's growth going on there. All three of those measures failed. Those were the big ticket items on the ballot on Tuesday. But, you know, I think in some ways what you saw Tuesday is symptomatic of kind of the school finance, the state of school finance, because you had large districts seeking money. You had one of the smallest districts in the state, Three Creek, which is out in the outback. between Twin Falls and Jackpot, Nevada, roughly speaking, looking for a $40,000 supplemental levy to pay for a paraprofessional, to pay for a teacher's aide, effectively, for 2 years. It did pass, but $40,000, I mean, that's what a district that small needed to go to voters for because they obviously felt like they didn't have the money any other way. I mean,
Okay. Wait. Let's talk about how these bonds and levies and the ones you're talking about can be tied to the one-day special legislative session on education. Oh, wait a minute. The special session that happened back in 2006. I know you were there, Kevin. So was I. Let's hop in your DeLorean. Take us back, please. Make the connection. Bonds and levies fail. Your education sucks. Let's make the connection to that one-day special legislative session back in 2006.
Okay, so what happened in 2006? A lot of political similarities between what we saw Thursday. One-day session, one really big bill designed to overhaul school finance. What then Governor Jim Risch was trying to do was provide property tax relief. So what he did was he moved about $260 million of school finance off of the property tax and increased the sales tax. We went from a 5% sales tax to a 6% sales tax, with the idea that the increased sales tax money would cover most of the difference and make up for most of the lost property taxes. Now, I was an Idaho Statesman editorial writer back then, like Brian is now, and we were cautioning on our opinion pages that this might not work and this might backfire if the economy ever goes south. And sure enough, sadly, the economy did go south. We went into the Great Recession, sales tax collections cratered, and along around the same time, a lot of school districts around the state said, you know, we really have to go back to our voters for supplemental property tax levies to help backfill what we need and what we're not getting from the state. I mean, a pretty strong correlation between the 2006 special session, the economic downturn, and the proliferation of supplemental levies around the state, to where now more than 90 school districts are doing basically what little Three Creek, Idaho had to do, go to voters and say, we need some extra money to do this. Will you say yes to this levy?
And it's interesting in part because, I mean, some of this, as you say, is fallout from that special session and changing the way that we paid for education. So, you know, if I were going to get back in the DeLorean and go ahead, you know, is the special session that came up yesterday, is that going to have an effect on how schools are funded in the future if I go ahead 5 or 6 years?
It definitely is. I mean, you're going to have this infusion of money, and let's assume again that this is new money and not, you know, as Governor Little envisions that it is going to be new money, additional money. We don't really know how that's going to be spent, where that's going to be spent, and how does that translate into student performance. I mean, it's going to be a big undertaking for legislators, for education leaders, for school administrators, and for journalists. I mean, we're going to have to spend a good deal of time and a good deal of effort following the dollars to figure out what exactly happened here and what exactly did taxpayers get in terms of a return on investment.
Well, as long as we're talking about great big sweeping things like water and education, how about reshaping Idaho's energy landscape? Kelsey, a great article in the Idaho Capital Sun. Tell us how the Inflation Reduction Act's tax credit could do just that to our landscape, the energy landscape.
Yeah, I think a lot of people heard about the, you know, vehicle tax credits and some of the home tax credits that were in the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed by Congress, I think earlier this month. But something that's surprising that I learned throughout this article was that battery energy storage is kind of a big piece of the tax credits that they put in there. And historically, we've had battery energy storage credits for batteries tied to wind and solar systems, and you had to use it for that. But they've expanded it now so that you can use it for just general energy, a general energy grid. And that's going to be a really big deal for Idaho Power because they're building a lot of, they are building huge battery energy storage system, farm, whatever you want to call it, that's going to generate about 120 megawatts of power. And that's going to come online next summer. And now this credit is actually retroactive to January. So they're going to get quite a bit of money back on that project that will allow them to keep doing this. And something that people misunderstand about our grid is that it's real-time operations. And so there hasn't been historically any energy storage. And so that makes it kind of hard to diversify your energy sources because the sun isn't always shining, the wind isn't always blowing. And so this will help really expand their ability to store energy that can be deployed when they have those really high demand hours and then be able to refill those batteries for the next day. Something that I've heard about last summer was that they really got close to needing to do things like rolling blackouts or, you know, like things that would have helped decrease the load on the energy grid here in Idaho because it was the demand was just so high with the heat. And as our summers get hotter, it's going to be more difficult to manage that going forward. And so this is going to be really helpful for them to be able to not have to rely so much on what energy is available right now and to be able to switch things on and off and manage that a little more effectively. And the Inflation Reduction Act is really making that possible for them. And it's also something that helps smaller businesses that are doing things like trying to replace diesel generators that I didn't really think about. That's not something I've ever really considered as something we should be looking at for climate change. But when you look at how many operations are run with diesel generators, like food trucks and things at like a fair or a tree fort, there's a company in Boise called Jewel Case that makes battery storage systems that are portable and kind of flexible, modular things that can be purposed for various uses, and up to like a tiny home you can power with one of these things. And so they're going to benefit from those credits as well. And their customers, their business customers, even individuals who are running their own solar panels for whatever reason, will be able to benefit from those credits. So it could really be a big, big change for small businesses and large businesses alike across Idaho.
Wow. And there's a lot more here. So jump into that story to find out more over at the Idaho Capital Sun. Kevin and Brian, I know you're both hip deep into the upcoming Boise School Board election. It's been garnering a lot of attention. Kevin, again, set the stage. Why are we worried about a school board trustee election? Usually these are really, really, well, usually. Not that long ago, they were very sleepy things.
And not just in Boise, Samantha. I mean, school board elections have been pretty low key around the state, probably around the nation. But there's been so much attention focused on school trustees at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, whether you're thinking about the pandemic and how schools responded to the pandemic, whether you're, you know, mask mandates or having to go to online learning, a lot of tension still from the events of the past 2 years. You know, factor in on top of that the debate about critical race theory and indoctrination and social emotional learning and all of those hot button buzzwords about the social aspect of education. And then, you know, what we just saw in Nampa a couple of months ago with that board's decision to ban books from the library. All of a sudden, school board elections are under a lot more scrutiny, even though these are volunteer positions. And in a lot of cases, they've been positions that have gone begging. Not this time. I mean, Boise, you've got 13 candidates running for five trustee seats. The election is Tuesday. And we've seen a lot of, you know, controversy just in the past few days over the Idaho Liberty Dogs endorsing several candidates, including one of the incumbents, Steve Schmidt. Schmidt did not completely disavow the Liberty Dogs, and certainly not to the satisfaction of a group that had been endorsing him, a PAC that had been supporting him withdrew their support. The teachers union is still supporting Steve Schmidt, by the way. But it just gives you a sense that all of a sudden school board elections are very political.
Absolutely. Brian, the Idaho Statesman editorial board released its support for the candidates. And I know you've been busy talking to candidates and researching candidates. It's a big deal.
Yeah. And Kevin's right. It is an unusual year. It has become a more politicized environment. For the Statesman's editorial board, one of our endorsements was swayed by an issue Kevin just brought up, which was the Liberty Dogs endorsement and Dan Schmidt's, Steve Schmidt's somewhat lukewarm reaction to that. That actually pushed our editorial board that was in our discussions, originally leaning towards endorsing Schmidt to endorse Shiva Rajbhandari, the high school student who is challenging him, who we were also very impressed with, but because we were worried about his ability to serve out his term, we were originally leaning towards Schmidt until the Liberty Dogs issue came up.
And can we just pause right there and say, when I was in school, I had no concept that I could even run for a seat on the Board of Trustees. How crazy is that?
Shiba is an impressive kid. He's been involved in a variety of civic engagement type endeavors, the Conservation League, different things like that. So I do think he's an unusual kid. But one point our board made in our endorsement of him is it actually maybe shouldn't be so unusual to have a student on the school board. The school boards are the authority structures that dictate, a lot of what students can, what happens in their daily lives. So it makes sense for students to have at least some measure of say in that authority structure. That's our view anyway.
Representation. Okay. We should note, Kevin will be back on the show next week on Wednesday after the Boise school board election to let us know how it all goes. And I want to thank you in advance for that, Kevin, because it's going to be something people are watching.
And just a final note on that. Yeah, so some people are watching this, but historically, these school board elections, especially in Boise, because they tend to fall on the Tuesday after Labor Day, really, really low turnout, like 2% turnout, 4% turnout, 6% turnout. It doesn't take many votes to swing this election. I'll be curious to see if the turnout is any higher this time around, just because there's been more attention paid to this election. But a lot of people are going to be coming back from a long weekend, and they're going to either not care enough to vote or forget to vote. Very volatile elections when you have that low a turnout.
And that means your vote's going to count, so go vote. We've been speaking with Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. I want to thank the Reporter Roundtable this week. You guys rock.
Thanks, Samantha.
Have a good weekend. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim and Godette. You're listening to Idaho Matters.